Our first witness is Mr. Stuart Crosswell, who has filed a statement of evidence dated the 23rd of July and rebuttal dated the 22nd of August. He has one correction, which I'll let him advise you of now.
So in my evidence in chief, section 5.4c is a cross-reference. It refers to 5.1a. It should actually refer to 5.4a.
Mr. Crosswell has appeared a summary of evidence, which he will read out now, and he's able to take any questions.
Okay. My evidence assesses the submissions on chapter 29, transport, as they relate to provision of accessory car parking and non-accessory coach parking, provision of preferential parking and charging infrastructure, requirements for bicycle parking and trip facilities, the regulation of public transport and public water ferry services, and high traffic generating activities. In relation to those various matters, the proposed district plan accessory parking provisions represent an appropriate reduction to the minimum parking requirements required to development as compared to the operative district plan, which I refer to as the status quo. And the proposed approach of reducing the MPRs is likely to have a significant positive economic and transport, impacts because the land use and transport efficiencies that arise from the removal and or reduction of MPRs exceed the costs parking management associated with potential overflow effects. Two, retaining the high trip generating activity provisions in the proposed district plan allows nuanced consideration and response to the potential transport effects of a development proposal. However, minimum parking requirements should not apply to high trip generating activities. Reference should be made in the high trip generating provisions to development agreements as a means of facilitating larger scale developments and maximising quality of development and community benefits. The end of trip facility thresholds and rates outlined in table 29.7 of the proposed district plan are appropriate except for e-bike charging and the showers lockers requirement for primary and secondary schools, which I consider should be removed. And the requirements for larger scale commercial activities that I consider should be reduced. The key outstanding matters of disagreement between myself and submitters who have filed evidence are whether A, high trip generating rules should apply to the airport zone, B, high trip generating rules should apply to the Jack's Point zone. C, high trip generating threshold for residential units should be increased from 50 to 100 units in the Queenstown Town Centre, Wanaka Town Centre, business mixed use, high density residential and medium density residential zones. D, proposed cycle and trip facility rates, which have been reduced in the current version closer to the Auckland Council or Christchurch rates, should be reduced to the extent sought by Queenstown Central Limited. And E, there should be additional criteria added to the restricted discretionary activity assessment criteria in section 29.8.61 that apply to cycle parking and trip facility shortfalls. And the minimum requirements for cycle parking and trip facilities should only apply to new building rather than also applying to additions and changes of use proposal.
Thank Questions I mainly want to deal with concern what looks on the face of it to be this proposal to substantially liberalise requirements for parking provision, particularly as they relate to the industrial areas and areas of the business mixed use zone. Now, I ask these questions from my background in private consultancy where I've acted for various clients that are doing developments and zones like this. In your paragraph 7.16, Rivers and Chief, 7.16b, in there you say, I expect industrial developers would act in their own interest to ensure an adequate supply of parking to support their investment, and if a greater amount of parking is needed to support their business model, they would act to provide this either by strategic site selection, works on premises to provide the requisite amount of parking, or arrange it for an off-site parking supply. Just a couple of things come out of that. I can understand that businesses will want to provide car parking for their customers, but is that a valid view to take in terms of staff car parking?
I think the business owners want to provide to their staff as well. Obviously, they need their staff, and their staff need to get to work somehow. And we sort of made that statement, I guess, on the basis that the council will also have a car parking strategy district-wide, which will regulate car parking on public roads. So the alternative to providing staff with car parking on an industrial site would be to say to your staff, well, you can use the on-street parking. In areas where there's no particular pressure on-street parking, that's fine, because they can take advantage of that. The issue might arise where there is pressure on-street parking, and in that instance, you rely on the council's strategy to send signals to developers to say, well, you can't please rely on on-street parking to provide your staff parking needs.
I suppose just use one example. The firm I work for acts for a major supermarket chain, for example, and they're more than happy to provide car parking for customers. It's definitely in their interest to do that. They go great lengths to do that, but they also go to unless they're forced to, they won't provide staff car parking, even though they employ a lot of staff. In fact, they'll even discipline staff and tell them to take their cars out of any customer car parks if they think it's going to reduce the amount of customer car parking, and they end up being down the road. So I just wonder if many businesses really, well, give a toss about the fact that their 19-year-old apprentice has to park half a mile away in order to come to work. But I just have reservations about whether that expectation is realistic.
Mm. Yeah, I can understand that point of view. I guess this comes down to, the fundamental, one of the fundamental reasons of liberalising parking rules is if business owners do take that approach, then I guess that incentivises their staff to perhaps take the bus or ride a bicycle, or worst case, then their business may not attract the staff that it may need. But it's really without some incentive to change behaviours, then it's really difficult to achieve those objectives of the district plan to actually reduce reliance on motor vehicles and make a transition to a more, public transport active mode.
council undertaken any studies in zones such as these as to what the modal split is for people, particularly staff, but also even customers for that matter, that come to these premises? How many come by bike, how many come by bus, how many walk there? Do we have any information? Does the council have any information on that?
I can't recall offhand exactly what studies may have been done. We prepared some technical notes for the council, and I think those technical notes are part of the Section 32 reports. At least summarised the types of information that you're referring to. And I'd have to review those just to check what sort of studies they've done. I guess our firm has been involved with a number of studies along those lines in the Auckland area in particular. And if for example the car mode share is relatively high and PT bike mode share is relatively low, that provides quite a good opportunity to provide opportunities for more people to use public transport and cycling and walking. In situations where mode share is more balanced, you've got relatively low car mode share and higher PT and walking mode share, then there's a lot of that opportunity has been taken up already by those people using those alternative modes, at least as a general statement.
Because what you've just described, sounds like it's sometimes described in planning terms as the new urbanist model of development, at least in European cities. And I understand that central Queenstown and Gloucester being, I guess, pursued to some extent, and it certainly is in some of the densely settled European cities, but I just wonder to what extent that's a realistic approach to take to places like Broad Road, Industrial Place, Glenda Drive, East Crescent and Wanaka. I'm a relative newbie to this district, but having been to those areas, it does look pretty chaotic at just any time during the working weekends, even on Saturdays, where you've got cars on road verges, Industrial Place, they're scattered up, Gorge Road towards the direction of Arthur's Point. It does look like there is a distinct overspill problem. And I just wonder, in the context of proposing to liberalise parking standards as a number of submitters have sought, that is an appropriate approach. That's why I'm asking this question.
Mm. Our advice at the outset in our technical note is really that the most benefit can be gained from managing those spillover effects by specific management methodologies like enforcing parking on verges or requiring transport management plans for companies to work with their staff to work out how they get to work more effectively without having to rely on cars or those types of methods rather than imposing like a minimum parking requirement on everybody throughout the district, whereby people may end up, it's been demonstrated that people end up providing more parking than is required, which results in inefficient land uses. And there's less economically efficient use of land, and is the other issues around urban design. For example, a lot of car parking, large surface car parks, development gets spread out further, that tends to feed back into the desire to drive rather than walk. site. And, so, industrial areas,
yeah,
make the point that, well, there's perhaps not a very minimal environment there to walk anyway. It's quite a busy and messy sort of environment. But, yeah, our advice was that it's more efficient to deal with that in a more targeted way than those particular areas than, you know, imposing the minimum parking requirements across the whole district.
I can understand that argument to the extent, again, based on my experience with applications for a Black Baldwin's Mall, where a lot of shopping centres, they might get a period where there's huge demand, like pre-Christmas shopping as an example. And if you provide parking to meet that kind of demand, you inevitably end up with hundreds of car parks potentially just sit there bare asphalt for the rest of the year. So that doesn't make any sense, and that's understandable. But in new paragraph 7.4, you move on here to talk about what you just mentioned a minute ago. QLDC is looking at illegal parking on public roads and reserve undertaking enforcement, council parking officers issue infringement notices, fines, having non-compliant vehicles towed. But some might say, well, that's A, emblematic of a problem, and B, that it's a case of an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. Isn't that a fair summation to make when you look at some of these areas in this district, such as Industrial Place, Reese Place? Because you're not dealing with peak parking there, you're dealing with day-to-day parking, which is inadequate every day of the week.
Yeah, I'd sort of, I'd maintain my view that more targeted management of those areas overall would have a lower cost and a greater benefit than imposing the minimum parking requirements across the whole area. It's one of the fundamental principles is that if you provide an oversupply of free parking, then that will encourage people to drive. So in areas where there's high demand, maybe that the parking is too cheap, free. So in areas where you I'll start using measures like pricing, then that will help, I guess, reduce demand for parking in that area. And I guess that's in the same bundle as compliance, monitoring, pricing. It all falls within council road management strategy, parking management strategy, that I guess really does need to be employed together with just liberalisation of the minimum parking requirements under the district plan.
But wouldn't one alternative to that be maintain your minimum parking requirements, perhaps have a standard like a restricted discretionary activity where people can make their case for reduced parking standard? For example, they might have assessment matters that talk about the ability to provide, say, they might provide transport to work for their staff. There may be other methods they could adopt, but if it's purely, well, voluntary, if you like, a very low minimum standard amount at all, the temptation is going to be that they are just simply going to externalise those costs onto the adjoining road network. I think that would probably be preferable given the issues that are apparent in the district in those good design.
Yeah, so I think I understand that. You're suggesting that the status quo, the operative district plan approach of minimum parking requirements might be a better way of...
Well, I guess I'm asking that question, yes, and people can then make their case, which they don't have to make a case if they've got a minimum low standard.
I guess our whole other premise of our advice is that that has been the way accessory parking has been managed, that's resulted in effectively an oversupply of cheap parking. driving more than they would otherwise drive if they paid what would be the cost of their parking, if they were paying directly for their parking. So, yeah, sort of comes back to recognising that providing parking, there's a cost involved with that. If the person using the parking space is not conscious of paying the price for that parking, they'll treat it as though it's free and there'll be quite a lot of demand for that parking. And that, I guess, increases driving around the district. And so we basically outlined in our technical note the case against the status quo. And
Welcome services has also been driven by sufficiency and to respond to, hasn't it? Which are asking for more local high conversion.
No, I wouldn't say that. Our original technical note on parking recommended liberalising minimum parking requirements, particularly in intensive areas of the district, town centres, and then high density residential zones, mixed use zones. It divided the zones into two categories, really, the lower density zones and the higher density zones. Our recommendation was to either dispense with minimum parking requirements or significantly reduce them within those higher density zones. And in the lower density zones, our comment was that we wouldn't object to minimum parking requirements being imposed in those zones because the cost of management versus the benefits of the minimum parking requirements tend to outweigh the cost of managing in those low density zones. It's almost the opposite that we advocated for liberalisation of minimum parking requirements, and some submitters have questioned that and suggested that there should be minimum parking requirements in some instances.
I'm just wondering, Mr. excuse me, Mr. Croswell, with the answers to your questions that Commissioner Nixon has put to you, how familiar you are with the district.
I'd have to say I'm not especially familiar with the district. I've visited Queenstown on a number of occasions and driven around Barrowtown ski areas and things like that, but I don't live here. I've never lived here. And,
right. So you're not that familiar with, for example, Wanaka?
Well, I've visited Wanaka and stayed in Wanaka. Time in Monaco, but haven't
lived in Monaco. Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is Commissioner Nixon mentioned Rees Crescent as having full on street parking continually during the week. There is no public transport in Monaco. Some of the suburbs in Monaco are quite distant, such as Leggett and Harlegate. Are we to understand from your answers that your suggestion is that people at that distance should be cycling to work because of the difficulty of finding car parking?
Our approach would be better characterised, I think, as managing parking in the public transport and the active transport networks in a way that guess, provides people with the opportunity to use alternative modes of transport if they'd like. And those people who need to drive, that will be an advantage for them, because the people who are able to use alternative modes might do that and provide the opportunity for, or the, make it easier for people who need to drive to actually drive and park. So people within higher density or active urban areas, there does seem to be a point you reach where there's only so much you can do with transport before you, car-based transport, before it's really saturated and you need to really think about, I guess, at least providing some, you know, opportunities for people to, you know, alternatives for people, and that benefits everybody, really, those people who need to drive and those people who choose to ride a bike.
Isn't the issue with that, though, two things in play? First of all, you have to have a population base to be able to provide a public transport service that means it's unnecessary to have a car on one hand, and that removes a lot of vehicles off the road, which therefore makes cycling, etc., safer. And isn't it true that even Auckland probably isn't at that stage?
I think it's a little more nuanced than that. I think it's not necessarily that people won't own cars. They may own cars and just choose to take 50% of their trips by bike or walking or bus rather than taking their car out. So if you consider the capacity of roads, for example, and if a road reaches its capacity to carry traffic, and for example, you take 5% of the road users off the road and put them in buses and bikes and things, suddenly that the road functions much more efficiently. So,
well,
it's more providing.
I can understand that in Queenstown, where there are some roads which have capacity issues. I don't think there's any roads in Wanaka that have capacity issues. They have parking issues, and it's not just Bridge Crescent. I mean, for example, around the town centre zone, people, staff there, particularly over summer when it's really busy, their parking moves into the residential zone, so there is no alternative for a lot of those people who are using the car to get to work. So I'm just wondering whether what you're suggesting is tailored to the district, or is it theoretical?
I think the advice we're giving is fairly universally applicable. There's areas in Auckland that could be comparable to Wanaka, where there isn't great public transport and people tend to drive more than they bike or take public transport. But the same principles apply in those areas. And I mean, it's fairly applicable. I mean, working in Christchurch and Rotorua and New Plymouth, the same issues arise and the same principles tend to provide good solutions for those different contexts. So situation, I guess it's the existing situation, the number of car parks they have in Wanaka are developed under the operative district plan, so the parking problems they have there haven't come out of a liberal accessory parking regime. What liberalising accessory parking regime can do is, in tandem with the council managing on-street parking, is allow parking to be used in a more efficient way. So, for example, under a minimum parking requirement regime, quite often restaurants or activities that don't necessarily operate at the same time as banks will provide a minimum amount of parking. And you'll find in town centres, there'll be, our experience has been when we've done surveys in town centres, is that there's a good proportion of the ancillary parking stock is unused, even in the case where there's a perceived parking problem. People can't find a car park. The issue is that the people looking for a car park don't have access to the restaurant car park because it's on private property, it's ancillary to the car park. So if you take a more flexible approach and perhaps uncouple the parking from the land use and allow people to use that more flexibly, you can actually take up a lot less land with parking but still provide the same parking service, if you like, to people who want to park. So
do I take from that your suggestion then, when you're talking about council managing parking, that council maybe in instances providing more off-street parking available to the public?
So you mean public owned parking?
Yes.
Yes. That I might refer to that as centralised parking resources. There's definitely an advantage in higher density centres. Queenstown's an obvious example where each individual premises doesn't have parking itself, but parking is provided centrally. And that's much more efficient than each premises providing a certain amount of parking and a proportion of that parking being vacant, and the next premises doing the same. So, town centre environments is particularly useful for those areas. In industrial areas, this was raised earlier, if people are providing or forced to provide parking on their own site by minimum parking requirements, they tend to be quite protective about that and they don't share it. Whereas if there's a more flexible approach to that, then a business owner may realise that 40% of their car parks are empty most of the time and choose to lease those car parks to an adjacent business owner who has a shortfall in parking. So the parking stock, I guess, is used a lot more efficiently in that kind of scenario.
Was a consultant in Auckland for many years and have assisted clients in obtaining consents where having car parking, using car parks that would otherwise be unused at the times their business was operating, enabled them to get the consent. So I can understand that as an issue, but doesn't that come down to what Commissioner Nixon asked, that if you don't require them to do anything, then there's no ability to get those sorts of cross uses
two, I guess, the incentive for people to do that is for there to be a market in parking. So to have a value for parking. In a scenario where you have minimum parking requirements, typically there's a surplus of parking and the parking's free. So there's no market for parking. So there's no real incentive for people to do anything differently. Part of the reason parking is free is because on-street parking is free as well. So there's, I guess, a number of strands that need to be pulled together that, I guess, in our view, could create a better outcome.
was the possibility of providing parking off-site elsewhere, and again, like Christian mentioned, I've involved with bicycle clients in the past, and one case that comes to mind immediately is a Christchurch example. There's it's a sort of a semi-industrial zone, a bit like the business mixed-use zone in this plan, and a former warehousing type unit within a block of buildings was converted to a karaoke bar, basically, by Korean clients. And that generated quite a lot of parking demand. There's only a couple of car parks on the site, nowhere near enough to provide it, so they leased car parks from an adjoining landowner who did have vacant car parking, which I think is obviously an example of sort of efficiency you should be talking about. But in your opinion, how important is it for those kind of arrangements to be legally secure in the long term? Because although we've got a resource consent for these people, it said at the bottom of the resource consent that in the event that the owner's lease is no longer available, which at some point in the future won't be, your resource consent no longer stands. But in reality, I don't think it's very likely the council would take enforcement action in those circumstances and close their business down. So when you talk about these arrangements, and I'm aware of this, just one example for efficiently using parking, is it necessary that these kind of off-site arrangements be legally secured so that they can continue to be available as long as that land use is operating?
I wouldn't say that that's necessary. I guess the variables in the environment kind of change over time, and it might be that the council puts in a bus service. Suddenly they don't need 30% of the car parks that they were leasing. And I guess it goes to just providing that flexibility to be able to manage around those changes in the environment. That, because I probably have a bit of faith in the business owners that they'll do what's best for the business. They need parking, then they'll try and find a way of providing that parking. And it's in the same way that you'd provide so many bathrooms in a building. You need to think about your development, what the requirements of development are to support it and provide that. If the expectation that you can just park on the street, again, it comes back a little bit to the council's on-street parking strategy. But, I think that's a flawed approach to running a business.
When you say a flawed approach in that sort of example, do you mean relying on an adjoining owner to provide you car parking, or?
Oh, no, relying on public on-street parking to provide for your parking needs to support your business. And one of the reasons I say that is that parking, that's a resource within the road reserve, might be that, in terms of the community, that the greater benefit for the use of that space might be as a cycleway. And so the council decides that the cycleway is a good idea, and along that side of the road, then you suddenly all your car parks are gone, and you have problems with your business.
This may be, my next question may be best for Ms. Jones to answer. She may be new. If you can't answer, so I understand that's fine. But does this council have require financial contribution in lieu of parking provision, so that funds might be taken, assuming they need resources, of course, that could be spent on, it could be spent on parking, it could be spent on improving cycleways, it could be spent on improving public transport. Are you aware of any such arrangement in this district?
I'm not aware of that arrangement in this district. I have seen district plans for that approach before, and it's specified in district plan provisions, even, but our experience with those has been that they are just to administer them is not practical. In the Albany area, for example, we were working there. Council have taken that type of contribution through resource consent applications over a number of years, so they had order of $300,000 or something in a bank account earmarked for car parking, providing additional car parking within the Albany Centre. We went in and did a parking study of the utilisation levels in that centre, and it turned out that they had sufficient parking, and the demand for parking could be managed through appropriate pricing mechanisms or time limits in any case. So I guess the assumption that the demand that somehow calculated through minimum parking requirements is the actual demand to start with, and that demand will be constant into the future is a bit misguided, I think, because as soon as you start charging $1 or $2 for car parking in a particular area, that demand changes quite significantly, is our experience, and as much as it reduces.
Questions, please, Mr. Crosswell. Just following on from these questions about the changes in the amount of parking and the parking requirements, how familiar are you with the rules in this chapter that are attached to Ms. Jones's evidence in terms of how they reflect your evidence and your advice?
Yeah. Reasonably familiar. I think there were a couple of, I guess, zones that were a little out of line with what our advice was, and I've noted those in my evidence in chief. And
because you've got quite a big group of zones in your Group 1, and the focus of the questions from the Chairman and Commissioner Nixon seems to me some of those have been around the business mixed use zone as opposed to the Queenstown town centre zone where there's no parking required, for example. Are you able to tell me what the differences are between the operative plan and the latest version of this plan in terms of the way car parking is to be required in the business mixed use zone?
Probably defer to Ms. Jones, I think, on that.
I notice in your car parking advice attached to the Section 32 report, it talks about the be quite high requirements for parking in the business mixed use zone. I think it was like 1 per 25 square metres of floor area and plus another 1 per 100 of storage. Now it's gone to 1 per 50 square metres, so it's sort of halved, I suppose. It's not like there's no requirement for parking. I mean, is it your, I mean, I'm not sure whether your advice is that there should be no requirement for on-site car parking in the business mix zone, or just less than there was in the operative plan.
Probably the best way to say that is, I mean, we wouldn't object to having no minimum parking requirements in those zones. And we see that there's a benefit in reducing parking requirements.
And you're aware that in the provisions attached to Mr. Jones's evidence, they haven't been done away with altogether, they've just been reduced.
Yes, yeah, we're aware of that. So we support that reduction.
Yes. And then the other aspect that seems to be new is that all of that parking can be provided off-site. That seems to be another new rule from the operative plan. I mean, are you familiar? I'll ask Ms. Jones about that. I mean, you said, well, it doesn't need to be legally secured, but the rule quite clearly says that it must be legally secured. It can only be 800 metres away, etc. So have you had input into those rules or not?
It's really, if the, I guess, the Queen's or the district contextual interpretation of our advice and articulation into the rules to Ms. Jones, really, which is obviously more familiar with the district and the local issues than I am. We've kept our advice at a reasonably strategic level and haven't been too involved with the detail of the parking rates, apart from providing a little bit of advice here and there.
All right, well, I'll ask Ms. Jones about this, but I was just concerned that some of the answers to your questions were indicating a greater change in the way parking may be more efficiently provided for in your eyes than has actually occurred through the rules.
Mm. Yeah, and I accept that, and our view is that the rules are a step in the right direction.
Thank you. So my second question is on a different topic. It's about applying the high traffic generator rule to the airport zone. In your evidence, you seem to be saying that you agree with Mr. Kyle and maybe I can't remember it's Mr. Carr that there is no need to apply the high traffic generating rules to, I think it's in your rebuttal evidence, to the airport zone. But then you say, I would agree that activities in the airport zone should be exempt from the HTGA rules. But then you seem to backpedal on that because of your concern about 3.4 and 3.5 of your rebuttal. You seem to have this concern about the inclusion of visitor accommodation in that zone. And you say if this appeal was successful, large-scale visitor accommodation activities could be established, and that those sorts of activities, as I understand it, should be considered through the high traffic generating provisions. And so then you say, oh, that means we better apply it to the whole zone. But is there a halfway house there? I mean, it seems like a concern about one sort of activity that may or may not end up being permitted in the zone, and then saying, well, then all activities in the zone should be subject to the high traffic generation.
just that a lot of those activities, well, the airport-related activities that are covered by the designation, outline plan of works, won't be subject to the rules in any case. So the airport takes up a large, large part of the land in that zone. And it, I mean, it might capture larger scale airport-related activities that are not covered by the designation. But those activities are already regulated through similar rules for smaller scale activities anyway. So you're not really requiring them to do anything else than they wouldn't be doing otherwise. There may be technically another resource consent that's required, but they require a restricted discretionary consent in any case, and the matters for that you'd be considering are the same, so they're not providing additional information. So in terms of a regulatory burden, it's not really a regulatory burden for all those activities in that zone. So the risks involved with, you know, large-scale visitor hotel accommodation or something, and the potential effects on the transport network, in my view, the importance of that outweigh the possibly minor burden that will be imposed by technically having to get a high trip generating activity rule for some of the other
activities
as well. So, yeah, on balance, I didn't see it as being a particularly burdensome for those.
Right, I
can understand. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope I've captured that in those sub-paragraphs.
I think Ms. Jones covers that too in more detail. So I'll ask her.
Yeah. For me. Because we've changed from the status quo, and there's some discussion about managing the parking resource. Do you feel that the status quo fails to manage the parking resource?
No, it manages the parking resource, but in doing that, it doesn't achieve the most efficient, you know, land use outcomes for the district. And it imposes costs on people who are not necessarily benefactors of the parking in the district. So, for example, minimum parking requirements for a supermarket. The cost of providing the parking is embodied within the goods you buy at the supermarket. The person who cycles to get their goods still pays for the parking, but they don't use it. The people who use the parking don't pay for the parking directly, so it's subsidised by the other users. And as we're saying, there's a better way of managing it to create more efficient land use outcomes and to create a better urban environment for the district.
And as part of that, as part of the council, we work through a whole, in Queenstown specifically, a whole pile of strategies, the town centre transport strategy, the integrated business programme case, which I've read. And as part of that came out essentially, I made a note that you, the QLDC will seek to maintain the supply of publicly available parking spaces at 2015 levels. And yet, we're also in the stage of trying to put two new car parking buildings in the centre of Queenstown. Now, okay, that's a decision that potentially needs to be made, but I'd just be interested to hear with you that
better urban environment for the people generally, for the district, because we support maintaining parking levels rather than increasing, particularly in the CBD area.
So if you looked at that and said, well, the parking demand essentially, if you ask the general populace, they'd say there's never enough parking. However, I see car parking buildings in the centre of Queenstown currently that are unused because of the displacement to the free parking that's provided elsewhere. So, you know, with the background context that you're offering in Christchurch, the council's actually built car parking buildings which aren't being used. I sort of wonder about the wisdom of trying to, and this isn't making a decision one way or other about minimum parking requirements, but if you're facilitating a parking building and then all that's accomplishing is pushing parking further up the hill or to another area that's free in the Scotsman, you do. I think the question I'm trying to ask is that the wisdom of investing millions of dollars in a car parking building, if your experience elsewhere has proven that to be ineffective.
Yeah, it all depends on the context, and I guess I'd say investing in a parking building too early could be a mistake. So. Really need to be in a position where people are paying at least a market price for parking on the street. Because if they're not willing to pay for parking on street, then why would they pay for parking off street? So you can go through some calculations to work out how many people are paying for parking on street and whether that is the cost of providing that parking, and then go through a business case for justifying a centralised parking resource in that way. So we're all in favour of parking, provided people pay what it costs to provide that parking, because then that doesn't disadvantage the other transport modes that people might choose to take. So in the case where you say people are always complaining there's not enough parking, I think that translates to that people are always complaining there's not enough free parking. So yeah, everyone wants free stuff. People tend to use free stuff more than they use stuff they have to pay for. So that's a sort of basic supply and demand type argument there. So through having a council parking strategy and a complementary liberalisation on minimum parking requirements, those sort of act together to send signals to parking users that actually your parking spot is a valuable resource, and that I guess you need to factor that into your travel choices when you're deciding whether to pay $2 to get on the bus or take your car into town, for example.
So can I get you to put your crystal ball on if you're actually saying building a parking building at the right time? Everyone wants to do everything at the right time. In terms of cars and how we're using them, is this looking at the minimum parking requirement, is this half an hour to the future of how we're actually going to use vehicles, or would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, if I was building a car parking building, I think I'd like that to be adaptable building that could be converted to other uses if it proved to be uneconomic in the future. guess that.
No, it's just that was being.
I guess that's
official.
Yeah.
Apologies. The one of the things a comment you made to your evidence in chief was regulating for an increased parking supply will generate several negative externalities, one of which being reduced economic viability of centres. Do you like to expand on that?
Yes, so minimum parking requirements requires people to provide parking on the site to ancillary to the activity on the site. So that parking is displacing other activities that could occur on the site.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I was just thinking in terms of if the shopping mall was providing free car parking, that might encourage me to go expand rather than affect them.
Yeah, no, it's more, I guess, the cost of the businesses that might otherwise be there that aren't there because the land's taken up by car parking. And there are a few flow-on effects that affect the viability of centres that relate to pedestrian amenity, for example. Having nice pedestrian streets is, creates pedestrian activity and economic vibrancy in the shops adjacent to those streets, whereas having to provide on-site parking, people tend to find, put the parking at the front of the site, which sets the activities back. So I don't think that's so much of an issue in Queenstown town centre, but in smaller centres it can be an issue where imposing requirements on the businesses creates a less amenable environment. And,
I can sympathise in terms of the Wanaka example because the camper vans parking in the lead front certainly makes it a less amenable environment to have your lunch. I'll give you that. I'm just wondering the.
There's no minimum parking requirements for the lake.
Yeah. It's about to be. The Mount Spain Road and the classification that is requested by. Is that Smith? I would want to know. In that case, council, it's referred to quite a bit. There's a document which is about cycling, and I've forgotten the exact name of it, but it's a document that was done in 2009, I think it was. End of use facilities. And how often would that, the update, should that be? There's no mention of it, for example, in it, of e-bikes. How often would you suggest, because it's relied on quite a bit in terms of end of use facilities?
So the document that recommends levels of.
I'm just trying to, I should have missed it. My apologies, but it's a document that was produced by council which was looking at end of use facilities for Copeland Water and its goal, end of use facilities for cycling. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of people have asked about bike storage and you referred to. But I note that was done in 2007, I think it was, or 2009. How often should that be updated? It's just that. Or is that evidence still reliable?
I think that's my colleague. He's assessed that side of things and put together the rates on bike parking. And he looked at various different pieces of information to settle on the rates. And one of the things that had the greatest influence was the existing district plan provisions. I think it's a three-park zone. So given that precedent, he I guess ran with a similar level of bike parking and trip facilities for the district-wide recommendation. And they're also looking at some international type examples as well. That coupled, I guess, with the desire, with our aspirations the district has for encouraging cycling and active mode.
One final one for me was public water ferry services. There's a lot of debate currently in Queensland, and a lot of people that are looking into public water ferry services. Is there an example in, outside of Auckland where that is a bit applicable, or even if you can think of it internationally, let's say gondolas on a similar scale and size to Queenstown? And if there is, how would that reflect in terms of a percentage of people that use it?
Maybe comparable to bus, end of trip walking for buses.
What's that? Is it a rough?
Yeah, around 800 metres is it's a rule of thumb.
800 metres?
Yeah, but you know, some people who walk kilometres and other people who won't walk that far. So it's,
I was convinced that the 5 kilometre walk from the centre of Monaco back to my place was the best hang of the cure of it.
Via the diamond.
All good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.